Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. You can, however, send in a question for our next episode by shooting an email to upfront@kpfa.org. You can also tune in for the next edition live and ask your question over the phone then. We normally air Monday mornings on KPFA just after 7:30 news headlines. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Ariel Boone. We are talking about the latest news in COVID science and public health, and we are joined, as we usually are on Monday mornings, by Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
Well, this week, let's start with the other virus in the news, bird flu. On Thursday, California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency over bird flu. Can you give us a refresher on what declaring a state of emergency does for the government, for public health officials, and for addressing a virus?
Sure. Let me just preface my remarks by saying I think it was a wise decision by the governor and his public health staff. What this does is it really allows the counties to work not just by themselves, but work well with the state so that the approach to this problem of avian influenza, particularly in dairies, is coordinated and integrated. This means a lot because right now it's county by county dealing with the problem, and now it's going to really not only integrate all these counties and coordinate them, but it's going to put more resources into looking into what's happening. For so long now, we, people in public health, infectious diseases, have been pleading with the government to do more and more and more. And this is a major step moving forward, I think.
So there are no recorded cases of person-to-person transmission of bird flu yet, but as of this morning, the CDC has recorded recorded 64 human cases, and 36 of those are in California. And as you said, almost all of them are from humans working with cattle herds. The CDC website suggested PPE could prevent bird flu transmission to cattle workers, but that would include safety goggles, gloves, boot covers, an N95 mask, waterproof coveralls, the whole getup. Is that actually being offered to farm workers right now?
It's spotty. It's being offered when it's available, and that's a problem. But a bigger problem is really the not just the logistics of getting the PPE to the farm workers, but getting them to wear them. I've not been in a dairy farm, but I've been reading a lot about the operations in dairy farms since this bird flu has been a problem. And it's really difficult for a lot of these workers who are inside milking the cattle, getting them all arranged for the milking, to be wearing all of the PPE that they really should be to protect themselves. So it's not an easy thing, and it's not just easy logistically, but it's hard on the workers to have all this on. So it represents a challenge, not one that can't be met, but it does represent a challenge. But beyond just preventing transmission, we need to understand better how this virus is being transmitted. We're making hypotheses. That is, it sounds likely that when you're working with a cow that's got a lot of virus in the milk, because the virus attaches to receptor sites in the udders of cattle, That splashes could get in the eye and cause infection, or splashes could get on the clothes, and perhaps that then if those workers go to another cow, or if they go to another farm where they may be working with the same clothes on, then we have a problem. This is called biosecurity, and we haven't been able to really block that form of transmission. So we need to understand better exactly how this virus is transmitting, or the different ways it may be, before we can really adequately attack the problem.
All right, we are taking listener questions. If you are listening, you have questions about the latest COVID science, which we will get to, or about bird flu, you can give us a call, 1-800-958-9008. That number, 1-800-958-9008. I have a question as a vegan who doesn't drink dairy milk. As you said, dairy cattle can produce this virus in their milk. Does pasteurization kill avian influenza?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And the good news is, yes, it does. There have been now several studies that have shown that pasteurization does kill the virus. So there's no risk to be drinking milk as long as the milk is pasteurized. The danger, of course, is if it's not pasteurized, and there are people who believe that unpasteurized milk is healthier. I don't think there's evidence to suggest that, but there are people who believe that, and they want to drink unpasteurized milk. This is risky right now. As I mentioned before, the virus attaches to receptor sites that are in the udders of cattle. And this puts very high levels of the virus into the milk. We know that cats, probably from drinking milk at the dairies that is unpasteurized, cats have died. And there is the potential for cats to, of course, transmit the virus to humans. There have also been, in California now, one household that was giving their cats unpasteurized milk, and they had three cats. All three became ill, and two of them died. Necroscopy did show that they died from H5N1, the virus that causes bird flu, and that the virus was extensive throughout the bodies of these cats, especially in their brains, which caused considerable damage. So I don't think there's any question that the virus can get from milk, unpasteurized milk, to cats, and there's every reason to believe that would be possible in humans as well. So it's another of the many reasons to really drink pasteurized milk products.
The journal Science Translational Medicine published a report this week that an mRNA vaccine for ferrets was successful in preventing H5N1 bird flu. We also had a listener who wrote in, David, saying, aside from needing far more rigorous testing, is there a likelihood of, I think David was talking about a human vaccine to be available anytime soon for bird flu?
Yeah, that report in Science Translational Medicine was really nice to read, because it does offer some really evidence that, at least with ferrets, it protects them from not necessarily getting the flu, but from dying from it. And bird flu has a very high mortality rate. So this was encouraging. The reason for ferrets is because ferrets, what happens in ferrets tends to happen in humans. It's probably our best animal experimental model. So this was very positive news. There is H5N1 vaccine that's available, not available to the public yet, but that has been made. There will be more that's being made. How effective it will be in humans, we don't know, because of course it hasn't been tried yet. But it does bring up something else that we really could be doing better with farm workers. And that is making sure they're vaccinated against the humanized form of influenza. That's the flu that's really increasing very dramatically throughout the country, especially here in California and a few other states in the West. These humanized forms of influenza, if a person is infected with those, at the same time gets infected with H5N1, the avian influenza, they can recombine in the human and form a H5N1 that is humanized now, meaning it could easily transmit human to human. So what we could be doing much better would be to getting farm workers vaccinated against the humanized form of influenza to help prevent that from occurring.
We've got some listeners on the line. First, our first question is from Belvedere. William, what is your question for Dr. Swartzberg?
Yes, Dr. Swartzberg, has there been any thought given to vaccinating the cows? For instance, with, they vaccinate them against tuberculosis. But if they were vaccinated against this, then would that prevent them from getting it and then prevent it from being transmitted to the farm workers?
Yes. Thanks for that question, William. And the answer is absolutely. There's been a lot of thought given to that. There's work on developing a vaccine for cows. We don't have anything at this point right now.
And our next listener on the line is Anne in Cupertino. Anne, what is your question?
Oh, we have a backyard orchard, and my husband's been giving away bucket loads of Fuyu persimmons to the neighbors, and I'm just wondering, what is the danger of eating fruit out of your own backyard garden? We have a half acre of fruit trees with some bird pecks in them. We usually cut those out, but is there a risk from that?
That's an interesting question, Anne. I've not read any reports to even suggest that fruits, whether commercially purchased or from people's backyards, have been a method of transmission of this virus. You make a observation that's important, and that is birds do, of course, have contact with some of the fruits, so theoretically it would be possible, but we have not seen that. So at this point, I don't think there's any concern about eating fruit.
All right, and next we will go to Berkeley. Ead, you are on the line. What is your question for Dr. Swartzberg?
Yeah, I just asked Dr. Levine, I think that H5N1 is very 1918 Spanish flu back again, because viruses are mutating, and that virus is very, very dangerous. At 100% fatality, which was detected in China. A child got the illness from playing with animals, then died, and his mother died days after that because she was caring for him. So we have to be very careful. Also, Berkeley have a lot of wild birds, crows, a lot of wild animals, skunks and raccoons and so on. We are big, big, big trouble. And viruses, as the doctor will tell you, can have 100% fatality, as in rabies. Only one child survived rabies after showing symptoms, bitten by a dog. We're in a big, big disaster. By the way, the Spanish flu started in America. Spain was the first country to recognize it. That's why they called it Spanish flu, which started in a military camp in the United States.
Dr. Swartzberg, what's your response?
Could you help me, Anne? It was very difficult for me to hear what he was saying.
I think Ead was talking about similarities to the Spanish flu in 1918 and also talking about dangers to children of animal-borne viruses and mentioning rabies.
Sure. The danger with, he brings up a very important point that's absolutely accurate, and that is influenza is what we call a zoonotic disease, meaning it's a disease that primarily occurs in animals, but then spills over to human beings. The horrific H1N1 pandemic of 1918-1919, and it really was horrific, with somewhere between 50 and 75 million people were killed in less than 2 years. That virus clearly came from birds to another animal or animals, and then to humans. So this is the way the virus gets to other hosts that it can multiply in. What we're seeing with H5N1 right now is it's a bird flu, we call it, because it's primarily a zoonotic disease in birds, but it's spilling over. It spilled over in other mammals, devastating populations, for example, of seals. The question is, will it spill over to human beings? And this is what we're very worried about, and this is the point that Eve is making. It's very important. And that is, if this virus does find a way to not only infect humans, but then transmit human to human, then we'll just be another mammal that this virus can infect, and it could be very, very serious. That's why we're so worried about it. People talk about an bird flu pandemic. Well, there already is a bird flu pandemic right now occurring. It's caused by H5N1, the virus that we're talking about, and it's devastating bird populations around the world, including here in the United States. And as I mentioned, it's spilled over into some other mammals and has really been very hard on those populations as well. So the pandemic is here. It's just not in humans yet. And what we want to do, of course, is prevent that from occurring.
All right. My next question for you is going to be about coronavirus. But before that, I want to give out our phone number one more time. If you are listening and you have questions about the latest COVID science or public health, give us a call. 1-800-958-9008. So we had a listener who wrote in suggesting CO2 monitors are a good indication of ventilation in a room, which could be a proxy for risk of infection, because it could mean in a room where other people are with you that you are breathing in their exhalations. Can you talk about this and how reliable this is and the limitations of monitoring CO2?
Sure. That's a really good observation by the listener. CO2 monitors are a surrogate marker for how well the ventilation is occurring. If in indoors or anywhere for that matter, but we're specifically talking about indoors. And it makes sense. If there are lots of people in an enclosed space, that we're exhaling CO2 constantly. So the higher the amount of CO2 that's in that room tells us that we don't have good ventilation. It's moving that CO2 out of the room and therefore moving anything else that we're exhaling, like viruses, out into the room. So that it is a good surrogate marker. How accurate it is, what are the false positives, false negative, what is the level at which one should be concerned? We don't have good science to tell us to answer that question, but this is clearly an area that would be very helpful in terms of assuring indoor room safety. And indoor is where the action is for respiratory viruses. Yes, it can occasionally spread outdoors, but there's so much air with the dilution, it makes it very unlikely. So indoors are the dangerous place. And anything we can do to maximize air exchanges indoors increases our safety. This is an area that it's been disappointing to not see better developed now. We're in our fifth year of this pandemic with coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. We know it primarily transmits indoors, yet indoor air safety has not really been a major priority. It's been a priority we've talked about, but the implementation of that has been disappointingly slow.
Related to this, one of our listeners, Amy, sent us this week an opinion piece from Journal of the American Medical Association talking about so-called leaky COVID vaccines, saying that they're good at preventing severe illness because they defend against COVID once it's inside the body, but that given that this country has not invested in massively overhauling indoor ventilation, it would be useful to have an intervention that stops COVID from entering the mucus areas of the body, like, say, the nose when you're breathing in air with the virus in it. I'm wondering what success or challenges there have been with this approach so far. There have certainly been some non-FDA approved nose sprays for COVID, and also whether this approach has been successful with other sorts of respiratory and airborne illnesses, cold and flu, RSV.
Sure. Amy raises a very good point, and that is that unless we have what's called mucosal immunity, immunity at the level where the virus enters our body, the nose, the back of the throat, the eyes, if we don't have good immunity there, the virus is going to infect us. Whether or not it makes us very sick means that we have to have good immunity throughout our system in our bloodstream. The COVID vaccines that we're using give us good immunity in our bloodstreams so that if we get infected, it does markedly help reduce the severity of that infection, ER visits, hospitalizations, and deaths. But it doesn't prevent infection. And if we get infected in our nose and throat, for example, then not only can the virus then make us sick, but it can also transmit to other people. So if we can find a way to create good mucosal immunity, not just systemic immunity, but good mucosal immunity, then we could prevent getting infected in the first place, which not only theoretically would keep us well, but would also prevent us from transmitting to other people. So a really good mucosal vaccine would be very, very welcome. There's a tremendous amount of research on this. There have been some very interesting papers just in the last 2 months that show that some of the nasal vaccines that are being experimented with can engender mucosal immunity that should be effective. But we're not nearly there yet. There's a lot of people who think, I included, that mucosal vaccines may ultimately be combined with getting a jab. So we get systemic immunity from the vaccines that we're currently using, our newer ones that we'll be developing, and we'll get mucosal immunity from a sniff up the nose with the vaccine. So that's where we're headed, I think, unless we can find a mucosal vaccine alone, a nasal vaccine that would give us good systemic immunity, then that's all we'd need. You asked about precedent for this. There is. There's an influenza vaccine that's approved for people under the age of 50 that is delivered nasally, and it gives mucosal immunity, and it gives some degree of systemic immunity too. And it appears to be fairly comparable to the shots that we get in terms of protecting against serious disease. So it's not like this hasn't been done before, but the hope is that we can get these nasal vaccines in the near future that would really offer us not only protection, but it would offer us really a potential endgame for this virus.
Well, the clock is ticking. We only have about 2 minutes left, but winter vacation is almost upon us for many listeners and for those of us gathering indoors with other people. Though you may have said it 100 times, what precautions do you recommend for preventing COVID and influenza-like illnesses?
Right. Good ventilation in those rooms. I know it's cold out, but the better your air exchanges are in those rooms, the safer things are. Tell people that you really want to be with them over the holidays, but please, if they have anything to suggest a respiratory illness, please don't come. I think those two things alone will make a big difference in adding a lot of safety. Things you can add to that, if there are people who are at very high risk for a bad outcome from COVID or other respiratory illnesses, is to ask people to test before they come for COVID. That would help assure that they wouldn't be infectious at the time. It doesn't give us 100% assurance, but it gives us another layer of protection. And finally, of course, everybody needs to be vaccinated against influenza and COVID, and if you're at a high risk, RSV virus.
All right. And I know this is true in my family. If folks haven't gotten around to getting their flu and COVID vaccines till this week, if they get them this week, when can they expect to have useful immunity?
Within a week, they'll have a pretty good immunity. Within 2 weeks, optimal immunity. And if you look at influenza, it's really going up pretty fast now. It's going to be a traditional influenza season. That is, by the end of December, early January, we'll probably see this really high levels. We're getting high levels right now in California. So now, if you haven't gotten the influenza vaccine, please go out and get it right now.
All right. We've got to leave it there. Thank you, Dr. Swartzberg, for joining us.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
To you as well.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for the next one, you can shoot an email anytime to upfront@kpfa.org, or you can tune in live. We normally broadcast Mondays just after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like The information is useful to a lot of people, and we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.